Well, I'm going to jump in here to the text and the message. As I said last week, we are currently in the season of Lent on the church calendar, which is the 40 days leading up to Easter Sunday, to Resurrection Sunday. And so this is meant to be a season where we prepare our hearts for that. It's meant to be a season of reflection and confession and repentance. Basically, we prepare to reflect on the death of Jesus, his sacrifice, his crucifixion, and then we also prepare to celebrate his resurrection and what that means for us today. Last week, we looked at really the boldness of Jesus and how when you understand many of the things that he was doing and saying in like a first century context, you realize Jesus had a lot of courage, didn't he? That he was basically saying, this is my mission, nobody's going to stop me. And to do that, we ended up covering a lot of history, which I know some of you really love, and you get into that thing, and it's like the best. Others of you are going, I thought this was church. Like, is this like an ancient history class? Is there going to be a quiz after this? And so, anyway, we're going to mix things up again today. I want to take a little bit of a different approach. I've been thinking about, just in this season in Lent, in these first few weeks, thinking about some of the people who reject Jesus in the Gospels, like they reject who he is, you know, what he was about, what he was saying, his message, and specifically people who didn't just say, you know, no thanks, but you know, I'm not interested, but who went beyond that and said, I'm like actually against this, and I want to work to do whatever I can to stop it. You know, of course, you think of people like Caiaphas, the high priest. You think of King Herod, we talked about last week. You think of Pilate. Well, in this sort of similar vein, I want to talk about a character in the Gospels who particularly as Jesus moved closer and closer to the cross. This individual becomes more and more important to the story. And this is somebody, you've all heard of this person. You all know his name. He's infamous in the Gospels. His name is, yeah, good guess, Judas Iscariot. I didn't even really give you that much. That was good. Judas Iscariot. By the way, as Christians, a lot of times we like to name our kids like biblical names or New Testament. There's a lot of names in the New Testament that are really good. Matthew, for example. I haven't run into too many people named Judas because his name is like synonymous with bad things. Sorry if your name is Judas. But one of the things that makes this story actually so tragic is he was one of Jesus' closest followers. He's one of the 12. He's an inside guy. And I've mentioned, I'm sure, Judas in the past, you know, in different sermons, maybe passing references, but I've never actually stopped and gone through his actual story. And why did he reject Jesus after everything he saw? After everything firsthand, his experience of Jesus, and he said, no. And what is that? Is there any of that, like, in me, is the more important question. And I just want to give credit here. I am drawing some material here from a pastor that I follow, Andy Stanley, who I reference and mention from time to time, but I just want to give credit for some of these insights here where it is due. So, now, I don't know how many of you, and don't raise your hands on this, how many of you have ever tried to, like, bargain with God? Nervous laughter. Okay. Now, you may not be a Christian. You may not even be sure you believe like God is like a personal God or anything like that. But I bet pretty much all of you at some point have tried to bargain with God. I was a pastor's kid, grew up in the church. And for me as a kid, growing up, bargaining with God as a kid and later as a teenager usually revolved around things like girls and curfew and just not getting in trouble. We have all bargained with God driving home late, right, over the speed limit, going, God, please, I pray, I promise, I'll never, I'll always, just my parents, don't let them be mad at me. We've all gotten ourselves in situations that we couldn't really get ourselves out of. You ever been there? And what do? Help, God, help, I'll do anything, whatever it takes, I'll make this up to you, I'll be a missionary to Africa, you know, whatever it is that we throw out in these desperate moments. Now, of course, as adults, this kind of bargaining, it looks a little bit different, but we still kind of have our ways of doing this, of trying to get God in on our thing. Like, there's something in all of us that, you know, if God has power that we don't have and he can influence things, boy, if there was some way I could get God to kind of get in on my deal and I could then leverage some of his power for my benefit, for my end. And by the way, sometimes I get this. Sometimes it's like legitimate, right? Like if you have someone you love who's going through something really difficult, like a child or like a husband or wife, especially if it's like a medical thing. I mean, haven't we all said, God, I'll do anything. Like if you heal them, if you fix this, if you make this better, I'll do anything. And so again, probably all of us at some level, regardless of our faith, regardless if we're even a Christian, we've tried to say, God, what do I need to do to get you to do what I need you to do for me? And we kind of bargain with sometimes our prayer. We bargain sometimes with church attendance. We bargain with our giving or, okay, I was already doing that. Well, I'll give more if that's what it takes. God, if only you'll do this, I'll break up with them. I will. God, if you don't let me get caught, that's a good one. We bargain with our obedience. What do I need to do to get God to do what I need God to do? Some of you maybe even have something from your past where you did this, where you kind of made a deal with God, and God didn't do what you thought God ought to do for you. And then basically you said, forget it. I'm out. I'm done. And maybe that's your story, and that's a reason why for a long time you walked away, because you know, if God would have behaved himself like you thought he should, then you would have believed, and you would continue to believe today, you would have stuck with it. Well, Judas was a man who tried specifically to get Jesus on board with his agenda, on board with what he wanted to do. He wanted Jesus to do his bidding. And what we find is when Jesus wouldn't do what Judas wanted Jesus to do, Judas walked. He bailed. He said, enough is enough. And I think the reason that this story is relevant and why we want to look at it is because perhaps there's a little bit of that, a little bit of Judas even in us. And I know it's like, Judas, really, of all people, like the thief, the man whose name is synonymous with traitor? Of course, our circumstances are different than his. But we've all tried to bargain. We've all tried to get God to kind of use God for our end. You know, God, if you get me the job, if you heal this person, if you heal me, if you won't let my parents find out, we tried to leverage him and his power for our own means and ends. And again, lastly, before we jump into Judas, some of you, this is the reason you walked away from your faith. Because God wouldn't play the game. By the way, he didn't agree to the deal in the first place. That's the other thing. Judas learned that God doesn't work that way, that he can't be conned into our little schemes. Judas, incidentally, wasn't alone in this, looking at Jesus as a means to his own end. The other 11 disciples, they had their own problems here, didn't they? And they had their own question of, you know, what's Jesus doing and how does what he's doing fit with my agenda, our agenda, what we want? How is this going to be good for us? Later in the Gospels, we find the disciples, this is a great argument to get caught having in front of Jesus. They're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. And they have this sense, or at least this hope, that Jesus has come on the scene and that he's going to do something really, really big. Like sooner or later, he's going to go public, he's going to go national, and they're eventually going to take over the world, or at least their corner of the world. And the disciples, early on, they start calculating. They recognize, you know what? This isn't happening like as quickly as we want. And right now, we're facing opposition, and we've got challenges, and we're barely scraping by, and we're off to a pretty slow start. But when Jesus makes his big move, when this movement really takes off and goes national, the whole thing, this is all going to turn around and we'll eventually kind of end up on top. And they start daydreaming. They start going, I wonder what roles we'll have, you know? I wonder what kind of privileges and titles we'll have when this new movement is like a full-blown reality. I mean, eventually, this gamble that we're taking on Jesus, it's going to pay off. We're going to, you know, the problem is, as time went on and that wasn't happening, they started to wonder, and they started to have questions, and they started to get a little bit nervous about what they were going to get out of the whole thing. At one point, Peter reminds Jesus of something in Matthew 19. It says, Peter answered him, "We have left everything to follow you. What then will there be?" And what's the key phrase? For us. What's going to be for us? Jesus, you seem to be forgetting that we've like left everything, like homes, families, careers, trades. I mean, we don't have a backup plan here. And I kind of think Peter's always like the spokesperson. So Peter's probably like, listen, Jesus, it's fine with me. Like, I'm good with it. And really, I mean, if I don't get anything out of following you, that's what I signed up for. It's all good. But I just want to let you know, like, some of the other guys back there, I've just heard them talking, and I'm just telling you as a friend that they have some concerns, and they're starting to ask what's in this for us, and nothing to be panicked about, no mutiny. I just thought you should know that, you know, that was kind of rumbling around. By the way, that question, what's in this for us? That's a question that we sometimes ask, isn't it? Haven't you done that? Like, God, look what I've done. Like, I promised and I delivered, and here's what I gave up. And this is the other thing that I didn't go down this path. I mean, look what I've done. I've even started giving. And Lord, I got out of that relationship or this other thing that was really, really difficult. So what's in it for me? Like, when's the benefit like going to start kicking in? And that was the question that they asked. And this is the question that Judas asked constantly, because again, for Judas, Jesus was always a means to an end, to his end specifically. Now, it turns out that not long after this, Jesus is arrested, which means the disciples have the sinking realization, like they are forced to admit, uh-oh, we're not going to get out of this what we thought going into it. We bet essentially on the wrong horse, all in. And then when they realized that they had, you know, everything to lose and nothing to gain, guess what they did? They walked, they bailed. Specifically, they ran. I mean, they denied Jesus in his moment of greatest need. Remember that scene, you know, in the temple courtyard where Peter's standing there and they come and they say, you kind of seem like you're with Jesus. You look like one of his guys. And he just goes overboard in denial. You know, when somebody's lying, they just like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. Jesus, I've never even seen it. You know, just on and on and on, digging a pretty huge hole. The amazing thing is, after all of that, that Jesus doesn't throw them out. Like, he gives them another chance. Eventually, one by one, they each come back. And they each come to a point where they are finally willing to set aside their agenda and their hopes and what they were wanting. They're finally willing to put all that aside for what Jesus wants and to take up his mission, his agenda. All except for one, Judas. And Judas had very specific expectations based on the Old Testament and what people thought in the first century, very specific expectations of what the Messiah was going to do. And in Judas's defense, the Old Testament was clear about a couple things. One, there would be a coming king, and this king would throw off Rome or whoever was oppressing them, and this king would reestablish Israel as a kingdom, like it was in the days of King David or King Solomon. Messiah was going to be a ruling king, right? Messiah was going to be a spiritual leader, a political leader, a military leader, a revolutionary. All these things kind of rolled into one. And here comes Jesus, obviously a man from God. And he seemed to fit many of these Old Testament descriptions. And he clearly had a lot of influence. You look at his teachings and his miracles, and he raised Lazarus from the dead and calmed the sea, and everybody was blown away by his teachings. I mean, that stuff like had to have come from God, right? And he's constantly talking about this kingdom of God somehow embodied or arriving in and through him, which got their hopes, you know, ratcheted even higher. And like the other disciples, Judas assumed at first that Jesus was just taking his time, that all of this was sort of a part of Jesus's like calculated plan. Like, look, he's not denying the fact he's a king, even a king in the line of David. And eventually, as the theory went, Jesus would like throw off the cloak of just rabbi, just teacher, and he would take the throne. He would take control and take over. And of course, their assumption was whoever kind of supported the king on his rise to power, guess what? They get rewarded when the king finally takes the power. In Mark 10, James and John, they come right out and ask Jesus to sit on his right and on his left, like when he's on his throne. And Jesus, who's, by the way, thinking about the cross, and not a throne. He says, nah, you guys don't understand what you're asking for. You don't want this. Like, trust me, you don't want to be on my right or my left in that moment. Strangely, for Jesus, he had a much different idea of glory than the disciples had. This king would somehow come into glory, bizarrely, on a cross. So the point is that he checks a lot of the right boxes, but then he says things like that are strange. And there are also a few other really notable exceptions to what they were expecting. For one, Jesus seemed like a little bit too passive at times, especially with like the Romans. He was way too easy on them. Like, he didn't hate them enough. He even paid taxes. One time, he heals like a Roman centurion who's a military official, heals the official's servant. And they're going, why are you being so nice to these people? Like, why are we going around helping the people we're eventually supposed to be overthrowing? That doesn't make any sense. He didn't exactly build up support with the Jewish ruling, like, religious leaders. He antagonized them. We saw some of that last week. And they're going, this is like a big thing we're trying to accomplish. We need all the help we can get. Why are you making enemies out of the people who happen to have what little power there is to have right now? He wouldn't get organized and assigned positions. Like, he didn't get the cabinet members and the new administration all sorted out. He didn't seem to be concerned about building a war chest, which, I mean, how are you going to fund a movement like this? You got to have some money. Didn't seem to care. At one point, at least at one point, someone comes up to Jesus in the Gospels and says, I'm sold, I'm in, I want to follow you, you know, this is exciting. What's your strategy? What's the game plan? And which, by the way, if you have people that work for you or you work, you know, you have volunteers that you coordinate or whatever, that's like your dream, isn't it? To have people who come up to you who are like energetic and passionate and ready to sign up. And Jesus here, and he does this other places as well, it's almost like he's trying to talk people out of following him, which is a weird way to start a movement. Here's what he says to that person who wants to kind of go along. He says, well, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man, talking about himself, has no place to lay his head. Hey, I don't really have a plan. There's no base of operations, no home base, no, you know, fortress, palace, none of that. In fact, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not even sure where we're going to sleep tonight. So, can you see how, you know, he fits some of the picture, but then there are these other pieces that as time went on, it's not clicking. It's not adding up for what they expected. And over time, Judas realizes, you know, Jesus doesn't seem to have the energy. Doesn't seem to have like the focus and kind of the drive. And so, to do what I think he should do. And so over time, Judas begins to lose patience. And when he finally realized that Jesus is not going to get on board with his agenda, when he realizes that maybe this 3-year investment is going bad, Judas flips. And in Matthew chapter 26, we see the breaking point. And this is near the end of Jesus's ministry. And there's a scene here I want to show you where I think this is basically the last straw for Judas. And I've never seen this kind of read this all in context and the way this comes together. In Matthew 26, verse 6, while Jesus was in Bethany, and that's important, Bethany's a small village, a town, about a mile and a half outside of Jerusalem, so pretty close, right, to Jerusalem, where like the big holy city. While he was in Bethany in the home of Simon the leper, and we don't know who that is, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table, to which we say, that's weird, that's gross. I hope Jesus doesn't ask me to do that for him or anything, you know. He won't probably do that, so you can relax. Now, these alabaster jars, basically they were sealed to prevent perfume or what was in them from evaporating, and so you'd have to kind of like break the neck of the jar or the bottle, and then all of the contents would be expended at once. And culturally, what's happening, this seems a little bit strange to us, but just to summarize, this is an act of profound honor and respect and deference that this woman is showing for Jesus. Well, verse 8, when the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste, they asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. And that word indignant in the Greek, it just means anger over a wrong done, like an injustice. Like they believe she had done the wrong thing. The writer John parallels this story, and he gives us a detail that's not in Matthew's account. And here's what he says. He says, the perfume that she poured out was worth 1 year's wages. Think about that. And actually, when you think about it, you can understand why the disciples had the response that they had. If right now the U.S. average median income is like $50,000 a year, let's just cut that in half for the sake of the illustration. Let's make it $25,000. Let's make it $5,000. Right? At some point, it's still ridiculous that you would take something worth $5,000 or $10,000 or $50,000 and ruin it by pouring it over somebody's head. And she could have taken that and divided it up in little tiny bottles and sold it and, you know, made a lot of money. She could have given some of that money or all of it to the poor. And the disciples are thinking, if Jesus is going to waste this kind of money, like good money, we're never going to get anywhere. We are never going to get anywhere if this is the kind of financial management he's going to condone. Verse 10, aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? This is her perfume, not yours. Meaning, she can do whatever she wants with it because it's hers. She can pour it down Niagara Falls if that's what she wants to do. It's none of your business. Besides, he goes on, she has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. We kind of rushed past that. They wouldn't have rushed past that last part. Wait. Go back to that part where you said, we're not going to always have you. And he goes on, he says, when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. And they're going, burial? Burial like you're going to die kind of burial? Jesus, you can't die. Messiahs don't die. You're the Messiah. You're the one. Why are you talking like this? And by the way, do you know how long we've waited for you? Like our fathers, 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 fathers. You know, all the way back to Abraham, we've been waiting for the one, you, to show up and to restore Israel and to be, you know, use Israel to bless the whole world through the nation of Israel. I mean, don't you realize we've cast our lot with you? Jesus, you can't die. That's like not good for you. And wait a minute, that's not good for us either. And you're kind of getting down to the real issue. If something happens to you, Jesus, what happens to us? Truly I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. And incidentally, this has come true. 2,000 years later, we're telling this story as it's been told for centuries all around the world. Now, the Apostle John gives us a really important detail to this story. And so just hold your spot if you're following along in Matthew 26. We'll come right back to it. Now, what you may not know is Judas was kind of behind the complaint. And not because he cared about the poor, and not because, oh, think of all what, you know, the good this money could have done and helped people and all that. No. Judas was the treasurer, and he had completely different motives. Apparently, he's the one who's stirring up the disciples. Because in John's account, it says this. One of the disciples, this is the same scene, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. You guys, think about it. Is this good stewardship? No. Verse 6. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Well, now, that's quite different, isn't it? Turns out he's not thinking about the poor. Who's he thinking about? Himself. By the way, back in the first century, these rabbis, and Jesus was a rabbi, among other things, these rabbis would go around traveling from town to town, village to village, teaching, kind of spreading their message, usually their commentary on the Old Testament. And one of the ways they supported themselves, and if they had an entourage, was at the end of that, they would take a bag and they would pass it around and ask people to put money in. And that way, they could buy bread and hopefully have enough money to go to the next place and keep spreading the message. Well, Judas, in charge of the money, I guess when no one was looking, kept taking money out just enough to, I guess, never get caught. What does that say about what Judas thought about Jesus, even early on? Like, there's already a breakdown here. And Judas found a way to justify to himself, I'll just take a little extra for me. But for Judas, and we're going to see here in a second, this is it. This is the last straw. I mean, Judas is sitting there. I'm imagining Judas is thinking, Jesus, I think this is becoming a little bit too much about you, right? Because we got other things to be dealing with, and you're going to allow, if you're going to allow this much money to be wasted, I'm not sure that I can trust you. Maybe I need to be doing something different with my life. I think, Jesus, you've lost perspective, and this, you know, I mean, here you are, the Messiah. You're supposedly going to throw off Israel and or throw off the Romans and restore Israel and do all these things. Maybe I picked the wrong guy. Now, here's where the story turns. If you go back to Matthew, to Matthew's account of this exact same story, this is when the music, if this was a movie, changes and gets scary. Look what happens in the very next part. Then one of the 12, that means like right after this whole perfume and argument and debate, then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest and asked, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you? So Judas gets up, says, I got some business to take care of in Jerusalem. And he walks out, and he walks the mile and a half from this home they're at in Bethany, mile and a half, to Jerusalem, finds the chief priest and says, what will you give me? What will you give me? And we don't know at this point if he just gave up on Jesus or if he was trying to cut his losses, like this didn't work out like I thought. Maybe if I, you know, creative, I can figure out a way to salvage something out of this for myself. Or maybe, you know, it's possible that he was just trying to force Jesus' hand. Like, he's taken forever, and we're not getting anywhere. And so, you know, surely Jesus, I'll kind of incite this conflict, and Jesus surely won't allow himself to be arrested. But regardless, and we kind of got a hint at Judas's character and motivation, regardless, Judas is going to profit either way. By the way, why did the chief priest need Judas's help? Like, they had a case built. They had the charges they were going to bring against Jesus. Why didn't they just go arrest Jesus themselves? Because over and over in the Gospels, there's this little problem, the crowds. Because everywhere Jesus shows up, there's a huge crowd. And they don't want to go into the middle of that and arrest Jesus and cause a big, you know, a riot. They don't want a big scene. And so Judas, an insider, says to these religious leaders, I can get Jesus away from the crowd. I can get him to a place where there'll be nobody around, there'll be no scene, you know, it'll be easy. And they said, well now, that would be worth something. So they counted out for him 30 pieces of silver. See, when Judas realized that he couldn't get Jesus to do basically his bidding, Judas traded his relationship with Jesus for 30 silver coins. I imagine he went out and found a safe place to hide this. You can't just carry, you know, what is your pocket so jangly? You know, whatever. And we're not sure how much this was worth. Most scholars agree it was a substantial sum, like more money than Judas ever had or held at any point in his life. And so this is a game changer. He's going to be set from this point on. Verse 16, from then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. And I've never really thought about this part before, but here's what this means. From this point on, Judas was constantly watching, kind of reading the interaction and looking for a window, looking for a circumstance, a lucky break where he could like deliver on his promise to these chief priests. I mean, that means Judas is constantly going, hey, what's the plan tomorrow? Like, we going anywhere? We do anything I should know about? Or, yeah, why do you ask? Oh, I don't know. I like to just plan ahead. That's all. Right? He's looking for an opportunity. Now that he's made this deal with corrupt people, by the way, who aren't going to forget about it, and, you know, payback's not fun, as the saying goes. And so he's got to figure out how am I going to tip off the temple guard? And again, whatever his motivation was, Judas takes matters into his own hands. I'm going to put myself first. I'm going to look out for number one, me. And eventually it's Passover time. And Jesus gathers the disciples in what we think of as the upper room. And they're going to observe the customary Passover meal, which is a long, drawn out, like literally like 4-hour meal. And they're talking and the conversation's going. And at some point, somebody says, hey, after this, why don't we head out to the Garden of Gethsemane and pray? Let's do that. And I don't know if it was Jesus who said it or if one of the other disciples said, you know, brought it up. But Judas heard that and he thought, bingo, this is my opportunity. And this is perfect because it's dark and there won't be any, it's late. There won't be anybody around. There'll be no scene. Nobody's going to be expecting this. This is the perfect time for me to deliver Jesus over to the temple guard and the high priest. And you can just imagine, this is kind of like a lot of drama, isn't it? And they're eating this long, drawn-out meal, and the whole time Judas is going, I've got to think of a way to get out of here without them noticing. I've got to go tell the guard about the garden and to be ready. And in the course of the meal, you know, Jesus gets down, takes the towel around his waist, and begins washing the disciples' feet, like, one by one. And Judas is just like, this is taking forever. Like, there's 13 of us in the room. How do I leave without looking suspicious, drawing attention to myself? And so he's figuring this out. And in the middle of all that, Jesus says something that must have caused Judas, like, his stomach to hit his throat. In John 13, in the middle of this conversation, this whole event, Jesus says, very truly I tell you, one of you is going to betray me. Busted, right? And they're immediately like, well, who would do that? I mean, what are you talking about? Who would do such a thing? And Peter's going, I may get to use this knife that I've been carrying around with me all the time for no reason. I don't know. This is just stuff I think about. And you can imagine Judas sitting there going, act natural, don't fidget, you know, he doesn't know, just stay calm, don't act guilty. But kind of fearing that any second now, Jesus is going to say, hey guys, it's Judas. And not only has he betrayed me, he's planning on betraying all of us and handing us over, all of us, to the temple authorities. And by the way, if you're Judas, this would be a good time to come clean, yes? Just to say, okay, I can't take it anymore, it's me, I did it, I beg you. Please forgive me. But oh no, he's committed and he's not going to back down now. So while everybody else is trying to figure out what in the world is going on, Jesus turns to Judas and says, what you're about to do, do quickly. And again, what do you mean, me? I don't know if you've ever been like busted for something, right? And your initial reaction is usually to deny and to lie and to, sometimes if you're feeling brave, to double down and to call their bluff because maybe they don't really know. And none of you, I'm sure, know what I'm talking about, right? Jesus says, I'm not going to stop you. In fact, I'll provide your alibi. Now go. Jesus lets Judas just have his way. He doesn't resist. He allows all this to play out, which I imagine at this point, Judas is so stunned and confused and like, he knows, of course he knows. He knows everything. He's like knows people's thoughts and he's Jesus. I don't know, I'm such an idiot for thinking I could like pull this off. And so eventually he kind of stands up and I imagine just, you know, I'm not going to deny it now. I'm just going to shuffle out of the room. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the festival or to give something to the poor. There he goes again, giving our money away. Jesus doesn't tell him. He keeps this to himself. And then he says something really strange in verse 31. When he was gone, Judas was gone, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. In other words, everything is working out according to plan. Exactly his plan. Now again, we're kind of reading between the lines. We don't know what Judas is thinking as he leaves in this moment. I think he probably thought, for sure there's no way this is going to escalate out of control. Like, he'll be arrested, and maybe they'll take him before the high priest, and there'll be some questions, and, you know, Jesus will answer the questions, and then he'll get a fine or a punishment, or maybe they'll put him in jail for a couple days, you know, I don't know. But I've got my 30 pieces of silver, and Jesus can figure that out for himself. Besides, he's Jesus, and I've seen him do some crazy, crazy stuff, and so I'm not even convinced they're going to be able to even hold him in the first place. But when Judas found out that Caiaphas, the high priest, had gone to Pilate, Judas was smart enough to know that there was only one reason why Jesus would be taken to the man Pilate, the Roman. And that is for a death sentence. See, the way the system worked, the Romans let the Jews govern their own issues and administrate their own Jewish religious law, with one exception. They were no longer allowed to execute anyone. They needed permission from the Romans to do that, and the Romans also would carry a sentence like that out. And so when Judas found out that it had gone that far, when he began to realize that Jesus, he's not fighting back, and he's not resisting, he's like going along with this, Judas realized what he had done. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. "That's your responsibility." See, those same 30 pieces of silver, going back to when he first got them and it was such a rush and he was like, "I am so brilliant for coming up with this plan. It's all working out." Those same 30 pieces of silver, later on, the thing that he'd put in place of Jesus had basically diminished in value to him, hadn't they? I mean, Judas realizes he just made a really, really bad trade. He traded Jesus for what he thought was a more secure, more prosperous, and better future in the long run. Jesus was a means to an end for him. What's fascinating to me, though, is in the short amount of time between when he got the money and when he tried to give the money back, the money didn't mean as much to him as it did. It didn't compare to what he had before he sold Jesus out. I mean, that same silver, days before, had meant so much to him, he was going to exchange his relationship for Jesus. In this moment, became completely worthless when he realized he couldn't undo what was done. And he tried to give the money back. He tried to wash his hands of the whole thing. But it was too late. They wouldn't take it back. And they said to him, "Judas, that's your responsibility. That's your problem. You handed him over, you betrayed Jesus, and it's on you." So Judas, when they wouldn't take it, and there's nothing he could do, threw the money into the temple and left. And then he went away and hanged himself. Judas, to use a phrase that Jesus used, traded, essentially, you know, silver. He got a piece of the world in exchange for his soul. 30 pieces of silver world. Judas rejected Jesus. And the interesting thing is, he rejected Jesus trying to preserve something he was going to lose in the end anyway. And he hurt himself, and he hurt the people around him, and we've all seen people do this. And maybe it's some of our story, or you know people who've done this, people you love, who in an attempt to preserve something, you're going to lose it anyway, one way or the other. They reject Jesus. You know, we reject God. We hang on to old arguments against God that we haven't even looked at since, like, you know, college or grad school, in an attempt to hang on to something that every single day has less and less value, has less and less appeal. I mean, the thing that Judas sacrificed his relationship with Jesus for in 1 minute was the thing that he wished, it was the source of his embarrassment, it was the source of like his deepest regret in the next. And perhaps that's where some of us today are living. Oftentimes, and you think about your own life and your own story, oftentimes our greatest regrets are associated with an attempt to hang on to something, to prop up something, a relationship, an opportunity, a thing that we think is going to make us happy, And later on, we realized that thing isn't even, it's like not even a part of my life anymore. I mean, not only has it diminished in value, it's not even here, it's gone. I mean, whatever that thing is, it immediately begins to lose its appeal. But here's the important part, and I think kind of the sobering part for all of us. When we try to do this thing where we bargain and barter with God, when we resist God rather than surrender to what he's doing and what he wants, even if it's different than what we thought, like Judas, we kind of end up responsible for the outcome. I mean, the chief priests say to him, you chose to walk away. The outcome is on you. And I think here's the scary thing. This should probably scare you just a little bit, like a healthy amount of scare. God will not get in the way of you having your way. He's not going to get in the way of me having my way. God won't get in the way of any of us having our way. And that's a little bit scary. And not because God is scary, but because he so values your freedom that he's not going to interfere with it, even if it means we're undermining our own future and our own happiness and our own success. As the poet W.H. Auden puts it, we would rather be ruined than changed. And Judas, when he couldn't get Jesus to do what he wanted Jesus to do, he traded that relationship for something that began to immediately devalue, immediately began to lose its appeal to him. And I understand why. Because we all have this in common. Because bargaining, that's a lot easier than surrendering, isn't it? I mean, resisting and arguing with God is way easier than saying, God, have your way. And I understand why, as Christians, we often resist the God, oddly, that we claim to trust. Because surrender is terrifying. And what if I don't get what I want? And what if, this isn't going to benefit me in the end? But as Judas reminds us, while saying yes to God, that's going to cost you something for sure. Saying no, on the other hand, will cost you more. Ironically, it usually costs the very thing you put in the place of God in the first place. And so this Lenten season, as we move toward the cross and the resurrection, that's the question. What have you put in the place of God? What's that thing, person, relationship, success, GPA, opportunity that you have elevated to the place of God? I'm just telling you, even if you get it, it's going to diminish in value. Even after you get it, it will have less and less appeal because you've traded that. You've traded in some ways your relationship with God for something else. It's diminishing perhaps already, and you've experienced that. And so the question is, has there ever been a time in your life when you have said, God, no matter what, I want to do this your way. I want your will to be done in every area of my life. Have you ever said that, those words, and actually meant it? Lord, this relationship, my future, my success, my friendship, my best friend, my attitude, this decision about whether or not to forgive this person and everything involved, God, I want your way in my life. And it's like, yeah, that's really risky, isn't it? And what's that going to cost me? To which I would say, whatever it is that you have replaced God with in your life, that's actually far more risky than his way. Because when you go that route, you actually take responsibility for the outcome. You say, I'll take that. I'll take responsibility for what happens on the journey. Because God honors your freedom way too much to get in the way. And so I just want to submit to you that a far better alternative is to say, even something like, God, this is killing me to give this up. God, as appealing as this is, it's not worth losing like my peace over. It's not worth trading my relationship with you over. This isn't worth it. So I wonder if there are some of us here, and the band can come on back up, who we have been, and here's the thing, I think that some of us, for a lot of us, this is not like all or nothing. It's like we're doing this in some areas where we've surrendered, we've said, God, I want what you want. But there are other areas, and it's easy to surrender when there's low stakes, right? Like it's easy to surrender your finances when you have enough money to pay your bills. It's easy to give God your health when you're healthy. It's much more difficult as the stakes go up. But here's the good news. When we say, God, would you take every area, would you take responsibility for every area of my life where I say, I want your will to be done? Every area of my life that I've handed over to you. So that's my question, my challenge, again, as we prepare our hearts for Good Friday and especially Easter. Is there anything that you've placed, you've put in the place of God? And over time, you will begin to see that that thing will diminish in value, will diminish in appeal. And I just don't want any of us to get to a place where we wish we could go back and say, I traded something I thought I wanted. And I gave up, in some level, my relationship with Jesus. I gave up at some level the thing that truly was the most important. Would you stand with me? We'll pray. Heavenly Father, for those of us here who we want to open our lives up to you, we do. But we're afraid of what we're going to have to give up, or we're afraid of what it's going to cost, or what we might lose. Lord, I pray that you give us courage, and I pray that you would open up our eyes and to help us to see that resisting you, not only is it not in our best interest, but in the long run, it leads to so much more pain than whatever it is we're afraid of losing in the first place. So give us the courage, Lord, to say, your will be done. Lord, I want your way in this relationship, in my career decisions, my major, my family, all of my decisions. I want your will to be done. And Lord, I pray that in doing that, we would experience your peace. That instead of taking responsibility for outcomes in future, which we cannot control, we could experience the peace that comes from, even if we don't know the future, and even if things don't work out like we thought, that we've submitted ourselves to you and to your will. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.